I'm Emma Taylor.
I'm Joanna Shanks.
And this is Murder, She Spoke.
So I don't actually have much in the way of true crime chat for you, Emma. I'm still in a bit of a true crime hiatus since before Christmas. I have been listening to an Ian Rankin audiobook called A Song for the Dark Times, but that's about it. What have you been up to?
Listening to some kind of YouTube channels, like true crime YouTube channels while I work. I like one called That Chapter. I don't know if I've told you about it before. It's the guy's Irish and he's quite funny, and they're usually only about half an hour long. So they're the right length for me to kind of have on in the background. And, he goes into the right level of detail for me to have on in the background and not get too sucked into it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And often they're cases that I've heard before, but because he's quite funny, I'm kind of interested to see what jokes he'll make about it. Or
okay,
so he's quite good. And I watched the 24 Hours in Police Custody, the Black Widow two-parter.
Yes.
Oh god, yes. That was mental. I was losing my mind a little bit on some of her acting. Yeah, so for anyone that's not watched it, it's about a woman that tries to get her ex-husband murdered, and it falls through, thankfully, and she's caught. But as soon as she's caught, she starts pretending she's ill constantly, and she's, you know, putting on a little poor me voice. And
she's got Munchausen's.
Yeah, she's got Munchausen's. So it's a wild ride. Definitely would recommend it.
I found it almost unbearable to watch.
She's so infuriating, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, I thought if I was interviewing her, it would be so evident from my face that I did not believe a damn word she was saying, and that I had zero sympathy for her.
I find it slightly impressive, actually, how many times and how many ways she, not in it, like, I guess impressive is the wrong word. I found it amazing how many different ways she managed to circumvent the system and twist things to her way and used other people's sympathy. And you know what? It really irritates me when people utilize a part of the system that's put in place to protect vulnerable people and they use it to their own advantage. And that's exactly what she did. And it was very frustrating.
It's a specific kind of manipulation.
Yeah.
I would say. It's just that extra level, isn't it?
Yeah, you've got to have no remorse and no morals to pretend that you're so severely unwell just to waste money, waste time, hold up the process, and actually just to maintain some kind of power over it. Even though you know you're going to get charged, even though you know you're going to end up in jail anyway, you just want to make it as difficult as possible for everyone around you. Oh my God, I could have. I'm so glad, like you said, I'm so glad that it wasn't me interviewing her, because I would have had to restrain myself big time.
Totally unconvincing and a complete psychopath.
Yeah. I'd be like, right, listen here, you. Nothing. Right, that's nonsense.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with you, so let's just get on and stop with the bloody tantrums. Hypochondriac. Yeah. Nonsense.
Like when my mum's got a kid that's kicking off and they're throwing a tantrum, they're like, there's nothing bloody wrong with you. Get up. Get off the floor. Stop it. Yeah. Behave yourself. Enough of this.
Absolutely.
Ridiculous.
Hello.
We Are You Should Have Ghosted,
a true crime online dating podcast.
I'm Shayna, and I love true crime, wine, and I met my husband online.
I'm Liz, and I'm single and exploring online dating.
We're ex-coworkers who became best friends through our obsession with true crime podcasts and decided we should make one of our own.
You Should Have Ghosted is a podcast that we hope will enlighten people to the dark side of online dating and shine a light on serious issues with accountability in the dating app world.
Join us for dark stories and cringy content.
see you next Tuesday.
What case have you got for us this week?
Okay, so when I tell you this case is close to home, Emma, it's a bit of an understatement.
Okay.
So this is the case of Mark Ayton. Have you heard of it?
No, I have not.
Okay. I'm going to give you a bit of background about the area and then I'll get into the case. Okay, because I know I wouldn't normally do this, but because, like I say, it's very close to home, I feel like I can and want to give you a bit more context.
Okay, yeah, definitely.
So this was the murder of a young man which happened in Balerno in Edinburgh. So as you know, I lived in Balerno for a period of time and I went to school there. Balerno is a suburb of Edinburgh and it's 8 miles southwest of the city centre. It's classed as an affluent area and there is some substantial wealth in the town. It used to have a paper mill, which closed in the 1980s. It's home to the Scottish Society for the Protection for Cruelty to Animals, SSPCA. It's on the water of Leith, which is the main river which flows through Edinburgh to Leith and out to the Firth of Forth. It has a rugby club, Curry Rugby Club it's called, several shops, two churches and reservoirs. So you people that know the area will probably have heard of Harlaw Reservoir, Threepmuir Reservoir, great place to go walk in, take your dogs, things like that. It's near the Pentland Hills. So for people that are not from Edinburgh, I'm not sure what the Pentland Hills are. They're just a range of hills to the southwest of Edinburgh. The range is about 20 miles in length and it runs southwest from Edinburgh towards Bicker. So it's a small town, basically. Balerno, it's on the outskirts of Edinburgh. Sort of typical sort of small town. So Balerno High School opened in 1983. But prior to that, children of high school age used to travel to the nearest town, which was Curry, to attend high school there, or they would go slightly further afield to Firhill High School, which is in sort of Collington, Oxgangs. So Curry is quite close to Balerno. Like, you could easily walk to Curry from Balerno. It's they're not that far apart, both small towns.
Kind of all on the one road, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then after Curry, you come to Juniper Green. Again, it's another small town. So they're all sort of quite close to each other. So children from the nearby towns of Kirknewton and Rathaw were also in the catchment area for Balerno High School. And when I attended, we often played host to some troubled kids who had moved to us from other schools. So I believe that at the time, I don't know if it still is, but, you know, you get the children's panel. And sometimes children that had come up at the children's panel would sometimes be sent to Balerno. I don't know if it was for sort of like kind of reform. I'm not really sure how it worked, but there was always that kind of impression that...
I think it was known as a good school that could help people out.
Yeah, I do. I think it was sort of like an opportunity to turn kids around. So yeah. we would get kids from much further afield, you know, who were all already several years into high school a lot of the time.
I think it's one of those schools that, because it is in a fairly affluent area, it's one of those that, yes, it's a state school, but it's a really good state school.
Yeah. So but that's what I was just about to say, actually. So the school had a history of good performance at the time, and it was ranked as a very good state secondary school. It seems that that's continued. So that was the case before I went, and it seems to have been the case ever since as well. It doesn't look like much has changed since I was there. So in 2019, the school was ranked number 33 of 339 in the Scottish State School League tables, with Curry High School ranked number 35. So they're only two spaces apart. They're a town apart and they're only two spaces apart. So they're clearly two very good schools. I think, you know, Balerno was historically known as one of the best state schools in Scotland, and probably as a result of that, that probably contributed to a rise in property prices in the area because people wanted to be in the catchment to send their kids there. But due to limited places at Balerno, some children who were actually resident in Balerno that hadn't been sent to public schools had to attend Curry High School. So because there was only, I think it was like 700 or 800 places, even though some kids might have lived in Balerno, they didn't always necessarily secure a place. So if the role was full for Balerno, Curry would be the next choice for kids living in Balerno. So it wasn't therefore unusual to find families who had moved to the area with children who were already of high school age, but couldn't get a place. So, for example, an ex-boyfriend of mine, he and his family moved. He was in, I think, fifth year when he started, and he managed to secure a place. But his younger sister, who was the same age as me, 2 years younger, she couldn't get a place, so she had to go to Curry. So that's just kind of an example of how it worked. So as I say, it doesn't look like much has changed from the performance and the reputation of the schools since I was a pupil there and when this murder occurred. So what I suspect is probably the case in most places, Curry and Balerno High School seem to be rivals, and kids would meet up to fight someone or several people from the other school. So there was always tension and hostility towards the other school. To be honest, I think that's probably just par for the course when you're at high school. You know, you sort of fight with the other school that's nearby, you know, the sort of rivals. You know, I think that's probably fairly common. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't think there was any real actual hostility there.
I think a lot of it's fisticuffs, isn't it? It's handbags.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mark Ayton was 19 years old in 1997. And had lived with his family in an area of Balerno called Cherry Tree, and he'd attended Curry High School. So he's an example of a kid who lived in Balerno but went to Curry High School. He'd since left school and was working as an apprentice mechanic. Mark's father was a tax inspector and his mother was a cleaner at Balerno High School. Mark and his brother Paul being an older brother, Paul was 21, Mark was 19. They'd been drinking in a hotel in Balerno called the Kestrel Hotel, where my sister actually used to work.
At this point, did she work there then?
No.
Okay.
It would have been a little bit later than this. So they'd been drinking in the Kestrel Hotel and they left at around 12:30 a.m. on Sunday the 24th of November. So Saturday night / Sunday morning, they leave, they've been drinking, and the intention is to walk back to Curry, where Mark was living. So as I say, it's because they're not that far apart. Small towns, could easily walk back there with no issues. The main road which passes the high school and leads up to a junction which then takes you onto Curry is called Bridge Road. So you go past the school, you come to a fork. You can either go left, which takes you down towards Ravelrig and Dalmahoy, or you can go right, which takes you down towards Curry. So Mark and Paul are walking along Bridge Road near the high school. Mark and Paul Ayton pass a bus stop on Bridge Road where a group of youths were gathered. So I think this might have been the bus stop which was right opposite the school, which would take you out towards town.
Yeah.
An insult was directed at Mark and Paul Ayton, and they turned to the group and confronted them. An argument apparently ensued, but then Mark and Paul continued on their way. Amongst the group were Ian Weldon and Paul Learmont. Ian Weldon was 17 years old, Ross Gravestock was 16 years old, and Graham Purvis, who was also 16 years old, had all recently left Balerno High School. They also lived in Balerno with their families. So near the bus stop, opposite the school, is a shortcut through woodland to the outer reaches of Balerno, which takes you to that aforementioned areas, Ravelrig and Dalmahoy. The shortcut was nicknamed the Green Gates, and the path led to the outer area where Ian Weldon lived on Turner Avenue, which was actually the street above where I lived. So you could take that shortcut. It was called the Green Gates because I think literally the gate was green at the entrance to it. It led you through woodland. I think you used to pass a Bernardo's, and then it would bring you out at the top of sort of Ravelrig Road. Ian Weldon and Paul Learmont made their way up the Green Gates towards Ian Weldon's home. They both seemed to have been drunk and they had bottles of beer with them. They sang Flower of Scotland, the Scottish national anthem, as they walked, and this is claimed to have been in relation to a rugby international game that had occurred the day before, on the Saturday. There have been reports in the media that the attack was racially motivated, as Mark and Paul Ayton had spent time living in England and both had English accents, even though they were Scottish by birth. Honestly, to me, this sounds flimsy at best. As you know, Edinburgh is a multicultural city and there are a huge number of English citizens or descendants of English. There were many children at our school who had either lived in England or had English parents, myself being one of them. You might get something said to you in jest, but it was never, there was never any strong feelings towards it. On hearing the boys singing Flower of Scotland, Mark Ayton suggested that he and his brother pursue them. Mark's brother Paul had a bottle with him, but it was not used in the fight that ensued. Mark and Paul Ayton fought with Ian Weldon and Paul Learmont and then dispersed. Weldon and Learmont pursued the Aitons as they made their way back to Bridge Road to head towards Curry, and upon reaching the points where the entrance to the Green Gates met Bridge Road, a bottle was thrown at the Aitons. At this point, Graham Purvis and Ross Gravestock came upon the argument and, being acquainted with Weldon and Learmont, joined them in chasing the Aitons up Bridge Road. Paul Ayton continued up the hill, pursued by Paul Learmont, but Mark Ayton went into the garden of 499 Lanark Road West and was pursued by Weldon. So this road that leads towards Curry and then on to Juniper Green and out towards town is called Lanark Road West. That's just the main road which takes you out. So that's the road where they were, and it was in the garden of one of those houses that Mark Ayton basically crossed in. You know, he jumped over the boundary wall or went through a gate or something.
Was he trying to get some kind of safe place? Is that what he was trying to do?
Potentially, or just lose them.
All right, okay.
Who knows? So obviously he jumps into this garden of 499 Lanark Road West. He's pursued by three of them, so Weldon, Gravestock and Purvis. They caught up to Mark Ayton and he was punched, kicked and stamped in the head and body. So this is three boys against one man while Mark Ayton was on the ground, right? The three then left Mark Ayton to find Learmont, who was fighting with Paul Ayton, and drove him away. After this, they seemed to have sort of dispersed. They split up, went their separate ways. You know, it was kind of done and dusted. So Purvis met up with another boy called David Doig and a girl. They made their way to the girl's house, and then Doig and Purvis went out again. A car pulled up, which was driven by Malcolm Ayton, which was Mark and Paul Ayton's father, and Paul was also in the car with him. They asked if the whereabouts of Mark were known, but nothing was mentioned regarding the garden where Mark had been assaulted. So Doig and Purvis continued on their way, and they came across the Ayton's looking for Mark again. So they passed them again in the car looking for Mark. After they saw the Ayton's looking for Mark again, I think they thought, let's go back to the garden where it happened.
Check if he's
there. Check it out, see if he's there, you know, see if there's anything going on. So Doig and Purvis made their way to the garden at 499 Lanark Road West, where the assault on Mark Ayton had occurred.
What time is this?
This is early hours of the morning.
Right, okay.
They found him there lying face down. Bear in mind that Mark and Paul left the pub at 12:30 a.m. They got from the Kestrel Hotel, which is quite far up in Balerno, to be honest. It's, I think it's up past the SSPCA, which is at the top of Balerno. So they walked all the way through Balerno. Then they came across the boys, pursued them, then made their way back to Bridge Road. So you're probably talking, I would say, at least 1:30 in the morning, if not later.
Yeah, it's at least an hour that's taken.
Yeah, got to be. So, as I say, they made their way to the garden and they found him lying there face down. So whilst disputing who should be the one to call the ambulance, Malcolm and Paul Ayton appeared with some of Mark's friends. So the good thing is there was no further delay. You know, they obviously maybe watched where they were going, followed them. They came across Mark and, you know, the alarm was raised basically. Mark died as a result of the assault.
Was he alive at that point then?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. It was noted by witnesses that the behaviour of the three who had assaulted Mark did not appear to realise the extent of their actions. So after they'd left Mark in the garden, the witnesses who had apparently come forward said it just seemed that there had been a kerfuffle. Mm. They didn't look like three boys who'd been like, shit, we've just seriously injured somebody.
Yeah.
Or potentially murdered somebody.
So they probably didn't realise at all that he was going to pass away as a result of that.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so. So in April 1998, Ian Weldon, Ross Gravestock, Graham Purvis and Paul Learmont were all charged with murder for the death of Mark Eaton. Paul Learmonth was subsequently acquitted when the Crown withdrew their libel against him, because obviously he'd pursued the other brother.
Yeah.
He wasn't present. He was involved in the whole ordeal, but he wasn't present or contributed to Mark Eaton's injuries, presumably. So I have a quote here from the Crown pathologist, Professor Busuttil. The post-mortem report was dated the 30th of December 1997. So the quote is, "The principal injuries were to the head in the form of multiple blunt force impacts, probably from fists and also, in some cases, almost certainly from shod feet. These injuries did not cause skull fracture, significant bleeding into the brain coverings, or externally visible brain injury. However, they would have required quite severe force for their infliction, and it is well within the capacity of this degree of force to cause loss of consciousness or more severe and even fatal brain damage." So there were no skull fractures, there was no significant bleeding into the brain coverings or externally visible brain injuries. Now, other experts from around the UK were consulted and they prepared reports in relation to the injuries. When it came time to testify, Professor Busuttil gave a differing opinion than the one he had expressed in his post-mortem report. A summary of the interpretation of that evidence from the trial judge, Lord Easey, is as follows. Quote, "What was plain from the evidence was that despite the superficial appearance of extensive lacerations and bruises on the face and head of the deceased, who, it must be borne in mind, had already been engaged in a fight in the Green Gates, there were none of the deeper injuries normally associated with significant violence. The facial bones, which the professor explained were designed to collapse, rather like a bumper on a car, to protect the brain, were intact. There were no fractures whatever on the body, including the skull. There were no injuries to the meninges and no injuries at all to the brain on external examination of it. Examination of the brain slides revealed only some very small, almost microscopic hemorrhages. In my view, it was an important feature of the pathology evidence that, as indicated by the professor, any individual blow was of minor force, and in their totality the blows received were still modest. As the professor put it, in the spectrum of degrees of violence seen in brain injuries, this case was at the very end of the minor end of the spectrum."
So essentially, they shouldn't have been able to kill him with the force that they used.
That's how I've interpreted it, yeah.
Wow.
And also it seems that the experts couldn't be conclusive on how he'd actually died. You know.
And also the perpetrators wouldn't have been able to look at him and say, no. Oh my goodness, we have really, really harmed this person. To them it probably would have looked no worse than any other, you know, fight, but you know what I mean, a normal, so to speak, fight that would end in mild injury, not death.
Exactly. Well, I mean, as I say, what they were saying there is the facial bones, the ones that are designed to collapse like a bumper on a car, you know, you know, rather than reverberate, you know, they are designed to just sort of collapse. So that they, I think that they take the brunt of the force.
Yeah, they take the force and then...
They were intact. So if you can't see anything visually, then, you know, you've not got like a broken eye socket or, say, a shattered jaw, or, you know, or anything like that. So, you know, how would three young boys visually be able to tell that they'd caused significant... Other than hanging around to see if he sort of... you know, got his wits about him and got back up to his feet, say. So, as a result of that evidence, the accused pleaded guilty to a reduced charge of culpable homicide, but it was noted in the court papers that if it hadn't been for the subsequent amended testimony of Professor Busuttil, the reduced pleas would not have been accepted. So he still would have been done with murder if he hadn't changed his testimony. Because of the lack of injuries, the various experts could not determine how Mark Eaton had died. Professor Busuttil believes it may have been due to some, quote, diffuse vascular injury to the brain, but others felt it may have been due to the inhalation of vomit and blood.
Yeah. In my mind, because he was left lying on his front and he probably passed out. I mean, he'd been drinking, he's had wounds and, you know, blows to the head. I mean, I know this is a silly way to look at it, but like, I can't breathe if I lie on my front. I'm not someone that's just been beaten up and been drinking for however long and, you know, left in that position unconscious. So it is definitely something that to me seems a dangerous position for someone who's wounded to be in.
Do you mean as in if your airways were obstructed?
I mean if you're passed out, you don't have control of how your airways are. If you were to be sick, if there was blood, you theoretically could struggle to breathe in that scenario. Just when we've looked at other examples like the Shaku Bio case, other examples of people being on their front, it can actually constrict your breathing in certain scenarios. It's just a thought that came to my head.
Yeah, I mean, I assumed that it wasn't the case that, you know, at first when it said he was face down, in my head I thought, you know, he's been face down, say, in the grass or soil or something, and his airways have been obstructed and maybe he couldn't breathe. But presumably then there would have been evidence of suffocation.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
So it could be. I think it is more like what you're saying, that his airways weren't necessarily obstructed, but the fact that there was vomit and or blood. I mean, assume there was vomit because they've mentioned it in their testimony. Yeah. So there must have been vomit. He's not been able to...
To breathe properly.
Breathe properly, yeah. Something like that. Or maybe just a combination.
It's just a horrible way to die, isn't it?
It is.
And it's really sad for me that these boys were caught up in it. I know that it's culpable homicide, so, you know, they've agreed that they didn't mean to do it, but at the end of the day, they did.
It's just sad. The whole thing is sad, and that's why it was a tough case for me to cover, because everything about it is sad.
Yep.
You feel incredibly sorry for the victim. You feel incredibly, you know, I feel incredibly sorry for the perpetrators, because I genuinely don't think there was intent.
Yeah. I actually feel sick for the dad driving around.
Yeah.
Looking for him, and that thought that maybe if they'd just told him the first time, or
they, you know, they might have found him in
thinking,
time.
What if I didn't run off one way and he ran off the other? Oh my, it just is such a horrific scenario.
It is. So due to the unusual circumstances, the trial judge sentenced Weldon, Gravestock and Purvis to 4 years in a young offenders institution, backdated to November 1997 when the assault occurred. So the trial judge gives this account of his reasoning. So this is the quote from the trial judge. In deciding upon sentence, I took the view that all of the accused should be treated equally, there being no reason to distinguish among them. I had to take account on the one hand of the gravity naturally resulting from the fact that death had ensued from deliberated inflicted violence to the victim's head, and the need to make plain to others that violent, disorderly behaviour cannot be tolerated. On the other hand, I had to take account of the important consideration that the degree of violence inflicted was modest and that the death was unusual. The general background, including the earlier aggression of the deceased and his brother, which in a sense precipitated the whole sad train of events, and the favourable backgrounds of all these young men who appeared as first offenders. In that difficult balancing exercise, I decided that the gravity of the offence was such that, despite the invitation to consider community-based disposal, a custodial disposal was necessary, and that the appropriate period of detention should be 4 years, which was backdated to 24th of November 1997. I would add that while I saw little likelihood of this or any of the accused presenting any future danger to the community, I was also conscious of the risk referred to in each of the social inquiry reports, that as the length of time spent in custody increases, so does the risk of the accused not being able to resume their previous, basically decent lives, but of turning to criminality as a result of an over-prolonged exposure to the company of others habitually engaged in that activity.
That's so fair, I would say. I usually struggle with some of the sentencing because you think, you know, for a life, how is that fair? But I can't imagine what his family think about it. I would be really upset that that was it, I guess, if I was them. But then also, if you knew that they didn't mean to do it, I mean, it's not the same, but say if you hit someone with your car and you know, you didn't mean to do it. Would you want someone put away for life? It's not the, obviously it's not the same situation, but it's one of those where it's not been intended to happen that way. And I think it really does complicate things that him and his brother went after them to fight them in the first place. I think if that hadn't happened, this would be a totally different moral argument.
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, that's it. You know, Mark and Polyton had decided to pursue them.
They could theoretically have just kept walking.
Yeah, they could have. And they were older as well. You know, there was a bit of an age difference. But personally, I think that the summary of the trial was really fair. I don't feel that the sentence was quite long enough. Because I think, you know, if you think about it, 4 years does sound decent, but when you actually put it into the perspective that
it's been backdated as well.
Not only is it backdated, but with good behaviour, you only serve half that sentence. So actually,
I always forget about that. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So actually, they're with good behaviour, which is likely, and which actually did happen. They did only end up serving 2 years, which to me isn't enough.
Of which they'd already served a year. Is that technically?
Well, yeah, at the time that the sentencing was passed down, I believe that the sentencing was in, I think, October 1998, I think I said.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that had happened. So it had been almost a year at that point. So I think I probably would have felt better if it was me. I think they should have served 4 years.
Yeah.
So I think if they'd actually been, say, sentenced to 8 years, knowing that they would have been released on license, for example, with good behaviour, which you know would be very likely,
yep,
I think they probably should have served 4 years as a minimum.
Yeah, I totally see where you're coming from.
I don't think 2 years is enough.
No,
frankly,
it doesn't seem it.
I get that I do think there was a lack of intent, definitely. I get that it's culpable homicide. But at the same time, these boys were technically adults, you know, under sort of Scots law. I know, you know, it's technically 18 for an adult, but I think in Scotland you're deemed to be an adult at 16. You know, Weldon was 17. Gravestock and Purvis were 16. They had left school. You know, you could argue that they're technically still kids slash, you know, just turn into young men, but they were just embarking on their working lives. They weren't young children who didn't really have a concept of what their actions were. And also, given their backgrounds and the kind of privileges that they would be afforded, I don't think that if this had been three boys from a different socioeconomic background, even if they also had no prior, you know, record,
they'd be viewed more as troublemakers. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I don't think the sentencing would have been as light. And, you know, regardless of whether they were brought up well or not, I don't feel that it would have even been a factor. I feel like it's only because of where they're from and where they went to school that I think it had an impact on the sentencing that they received.
I mean, can you imagine if it had been three private schoolboys?
Yeah.
So.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a really sad case anyway. This makes it a bit sadder. So Weldon was the son of a police chief inspector. So Weldon was working as an apprentice electrician at the time of the murder. Purvis was the son of the managing director of Waddy's, which was a former Edinburgh printing company. He was working as an apprentice engineer with British Telecom at the time of the murder. And Gravestock was the son of a senior civil servant and a public school teacher. He was working in a supermarket at the time of the murder. Now, the day after it happened, Ian Weldon's dad actually drove him to the police station to confess.
Oh.
So,
wow.
Ian Weldon's dad, like I say, he was a police chief inspector. He spoke to his son, took his son into the station himself. I think he was a police chief inspector at West End Police Station in Edinburgh. He took Ian in and basically
said, tell them what you did.
Yeah, completely cooperated. Tell them what happened. Basically explained everything, completely cooperated, said what happened, faced up to his actions, and apparently he expressed severe remorse for, obviously, when he found out what had happened as a result. So that, to me, that just makes it kind of just even that bit sadder.
It does, but it also gives me hope. And it kind of makes me think that he was brought up correctly. He's been shown that you have to pay for your actions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the truth is, Emma, that quite frankly, that's what would have happened to me. Mm-hmm. If I was in his shoes, my dad would have driven me to the police station the next day and said, tell them what happened, be honest, cooperate. And that's the way I was brought up. You know, it doesn't matter whether you meant it or not. You face the consequences of your actions and you take the punishment that's doled out.
Yeah. That's why we have culpable homicide as
exactly.
an option. You know, that's why manslaughter exists in America. It's the same thing.
So he absolutely did the right thing. But to me, it just made it all that bit sadder.
Mm.
Because you've just got so many lives that have been ruined here.
Yeah, you can imagine his dad driving them there feeling like their mm-hmm. worlds were falling apart around them.
So an appeal by the Crown for a harsher sentence against the boys was rejected by Lord Justice General Hope in October 1998. So a year after the offence, that appeal was refused. And the three boys, who are obviously now men, were released after serving 2 years. So, and also bear in mind that they had siblings that went to the school. So, yeah, I was there at the time this happened. And just everything about it was just tragic, was just so sad. It was just, I remember just there being this real kind of just sadness that just seeped over everybody that this whole situation had occurred.
Do you feel that it affected how the teens afterwards dealt with each other? Do you think that it made any difference to, you know, inter youth violence, or, you know, do you think there was anything that came of it really?
I can't really say, because I was just beginning high school.
Mm.
So I just started the year that this happened.
Fair enough.
So I was still, you know, I would have been 11, 12 when this happened. So it would be probably for an older student at the time to say. But I do know that I don't think there was any, that I'm aware of from my time there, that was any real serious violence that happened, maybe other than, you know, some bad punch-ups between people that had long-term grudges. You know, I don't think that there was anything really like this that happened after that point.
I think for me, these are the kind of stories that I would want to tell any children that I had.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And so this, and also ones along the lines of the stories where someone gets killed with one punch, you know, and just to scare them, honestly, that these things do and can happen. And you can't tell if that one that you get in a fight, something is going to happen.
Exactly. You might not know if somebody has an existing medical condition.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't know. Mm-hmm. That's it. You don't know. And that's why it's best just to walk away, just not to, because you just don't know what's going to happen. You don't know that.
Yeah.
The thing is, as well, is that Palermo is one of those, it's small town. It's everybody knows everybody's business. It's like, to me, I find it kind of suffocating. I don't think I could ever live there again. But you know, everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows everybody's business. And, you know, it's not something that you could probably ever escape.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is the case of Mark Eaton. Maybe you have something lighthearted to cheer us up.
I do. I've
a little story or tidbit.
I've got a story. It's
crime-related joke, or
no? I've actually got a full story, a little story for you.
Okay, nice.
I'm going to recklessly steal the wording from the Independent, who wrote about it, because there's a couple of bits to the story. So, I don't know if you've heard of Ray Reza Bellucci.
Don't think so.
No. So this man has managed to get arrested by the Coast Guard in the US. Twice. He attempts to run across the sea in an inflatable bubble that he made himself. So it looks a bit like
Zorbing.
Yeah.
Zorbing like balls,
basically. So he's an ultramarathon runner. He basically thinks he's the dog's bollocks, and he's not. So he had planned a quote-unquote life-threatening journey at sea. He was trying to raise money for a children's charity, but he first tried it in 2014, and he'd been warned not to. So the Coast Guard first rescued Mr. Bellucci back in 2014 after being told, now this is my favourite bit, there was a disoriented man in a bubble near the Miami coastline asking for directions to Bermuda. Seems like not even that far away from Florida. And who's he asking? Like, who's he approaching in this bubble thing? It looks like a hamster wheel.
Excuse me, Coast Guard.
Oh my God. And I read a couple of articles about it, and like he was putting out his plans, and it was like, don't worry, I'm gonna have like protein bars in there and some water. Like, what are you even doing? You can't run to Bermuda. How stupid are you? After that episode, the runner was warned earlier this month not to attempt this challenge because your vessels and the conditions under which you're attempting to complete your voyage to Bermuda is unsafe, according to the Coast Guard. So Benny tried again in 2016. Wow. So he calls it a hydropod. I really do recommend that you look it up because it's just not a thing. It's it's a hamster wheel meat-a-zorb. It's the nonsense.
Also, like, I mean, would there not be concerns about temperature, hydration, all that kind of stuff? Like, what if it's a hot day? He would basically bake in that thing.
Yeah, so he only made it 7 miles off the coast the second time.
Yeah, because did you say it was Florida?
He started in Florida and he was planning on going to Bermuda. He was planning on running to Bermuda in a hydropod across the sea.
This might sound like a stupid question, but how far is Bermuda from Florida?
It is over 1,000 miles.
What?
I mean, that is just ridiculous.
What a numpty.
I know, total numpty. After the most recent rescue, it was revealed how much the first failed attempt had cost the taxpayer. It was $144,000. So there was an airplane, a helicopter, and a vessel all deployed to save him. And then he was ordered not to depart again, and he did again. So he was planning it being a 5-month journey, and he had planned to eat on his, 1,033-mile run. He was going to catch fish and prepare some homemade protein bars, all from within the self-designed hydropod. If he didn't comply again, he could have up to 7 years in jail and a $40,000 fine.
That would have burst his bubble.
I really do urge you to look at this thing. I'm going to send you it right now.
Okay.
I mean, it's the fact that he didn't even get more than 7 miles away and he was asking for directions.
What twat?
He's just like, Bermuda? Do you know which way? Like, how do you not have a compass? You've got a self-designed hydropod. How do you not have a compass in there? This is a nonsense. It's not a habitable...
What?
...pod. And the people that are there are just like, oh, for fuck's sake, not this guy again.
Ridiculous.
There you go. Ray Bellucci.
Bubble man.
Bubble man.
Bubble boy.
Thank you so much for listening. If you want to get in contact with us, perhaps with a case recommendation, you can email us at info@murdershespoke.net. You can also get in contact with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if you've enjoyed listening, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. We'll see you in a week. Bye!